What is life all about? Psalm 1 by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. A tour of Psalm 1, considering the questions, where do we find out what life is about? What difference does it make in this life? What difference does it make when we die? Psalms 1 and 2 appear to function as an introduction to the whole book of Psalms. Psalm 1, what is life individually all about? Psalm 2, what is history, that is the life of societies, all about? We will look at the first of these in this PowerPoint talk, entitled What is Life All About? And the second in another PowerPoint talk entitled What is History All About? Psalm 1 divides into three sections of two verses each. Suggest a heading for each of these sections goes like this. Where do we find out what life is about? Verses 1 and 2. What difference does it make here and now? Verses 3 and 4. And what difference will it make when we die? Verses 5 and 6. We start with a translation of the whole psalm. Oh, the happiness of the man who does not walk in the advice of the wicked, nor stand in the pathway with sinners, nor sit in the seat of mockers, but rather his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. So he shall be like a tree, planted by streams of water, bearing its fruit in its season, nor do its leaves fall off, but all it produces it brings to maturity. Not so the wicked, but like chaff the wind scatters. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the path of the righteous, but the path of the wicked will perish. Where do we find out? Well, we have a picture here in this first psalm of life as a journey. It talks about walking and standing on the road and sitting in a seat, if you like. And where do we find out what life is all about? First of all, from other humans, verse 1. Here life is pictured as a journey from birth to death. And the psalm tells us basically, don't take your advice on how to hike this journey from those who are wicked. The pathways along life's journey are various lifestyles, various ways of getting from one place to another. And we're told here not to adopt the lifestyle of the sinner. What are we to make of this seat beside the road? That's my suggestion for the third section here. Perhaps we're looking here at a worked-out justification, a philosophy of life, a worldview, if you like. And the advice of the psalm is don't adopt the philosophy of a mocker. Where do we find out what life is all about? Verse 2, we find out from God. We're told to delight in the law. You say, that's a strange idea in today's society, where law is generally viewed as restrictive in one way or another. And I agree, that's a common view in today's society. And in fact, that will come up in Psalm 2. And yet, scientists delight in discovering natural laws. They compete with one another to see who can discover laws that haven't been discovered yet. And then engineers, those who apply what has been found by scientists, delight in obeying natural laws, we might say, and finding out how using our knowledge of natural laws can help us to transform our own lives. Well, I suggest from this psalm that the Bible believers, Christians, should be like scientists and engineers In regard to God's moral laws. We should delight in discovering God's moral laws. We should delight in obeying God's moral laws. Where do we find out what life is all about? We find it from God. Who else really knows what life is about? He's been here since the beginning. He created life, and he knows what's going to happen in the future. Blessed is the one who delights in God's law, thinking about it continually. Well, what difference does it make here and now where we find out about what life is all about and what we find out about what life is all about? Well, here the psalmist gives us a contrast, pictured in two diverse images that come to us from farming. He gives us a picture in verse 3 of a tree and in verse 4 of chaff. We look first of all at the tree. This is a planted tree, so it's not one that kind of grew up by itself, although obviously trees do grow up by themselves, but it's one that the farmer has put there. Okay? It's a watered tree. We wouldn't think about that too much in the places I come from because we get 40 inches of rainfall a year or something of that sort, and trees get adequately watered. But the psalmist is writing this in a geography in which you don't get that much water, and in which a tree that is watered, a tree that is irrigated, is a tree that is going to have special advantages over trees that are not irrigated. The tree is also pictured as a fruitful tree, a planted tree, a watered tree, a fruitful tree. We're picturing here presumably then a fruit tree of some sort, a fig tree or an olive tree or an apricot tree or something of the sort that would have grown in the Middle East at the time the psalmist writes. And it's a healthy tree. Its leaves do not wither. Okay, that could, of course, just be lack of water, but we're already told it's watered, so we're probably looking here at a healthy tree. And it's a mature tree. It's a tree that is producing its fruit now, and its fruit is growing to maturity, is the way I've handled that particular line of the psalm. You know, it produces good fruit. What picture does it make here now? The tree is a picture of one who does take his advice from God and not from the other humans around him. Mm. And that tree, that person then, will be like this kind of a tree, like a tree that is planted by the farmer, watered by him one way or another, fruitful for him, healthy, mature, etc. The one who takes advice on what life is about from God is one who is planted by God for God's benefit, but also for the tree's multi-season usefulness. Contrast that with the chaff. Chaff can be various things, but probably here we're going to think of it as the hull on the grain of, say, wheat, a common crop in the Middle East. Chaff is not like the tree, huh? The chaff is blown away when the grain is harvested. Grain grows up, of course. It's a plant that needs to be planted each year, though the seeds from it can replant themselves in certain circumstances. As the grain ripens and begins to turn now yellow and brown instead of the green that originally was, the heads of the wheat are cut off from the rest of the grass, and they are put in a threshing floor, usually a stone floor, outcrop of rock somewhere, and they are walked over by typically oxen to break the hull that's on the grain, and then the farmer, on a breezy day, goes through with a shovel and picks up the grain and throws it in the air, and the wind blows the hull, the chaff, away, and the grain falls back down to the threshing floor. So the chaff, the hull of the grain, not like the tree, blown away. The chaff benefits with the wheat until the harvest, right? Shares in all the benefits that the wheat receives, but then at the harvest, the chaff is discarded. It's got a one-season use. It has no root. It has no fruit. So it's connected with a root and gets benefit from it, and it's connected with fruit and benefits with the fruit until the harvest comes. We come last of all, and that's the picture then that we're getting of those who don't take their advice from God. They may still benefit during this life, but they've only got a one-season usefulness. They won't thwart God, and God will make use of them in this life. but they will not have season after season fruitfulness. We turn to the third point then in verses 5 and 6. What difference does it make when we die? What difference does it make that we took our advice from God rather than humans and that we lived out a lifestyle that was consistent with that? Well, we then look in verse 5 at the judgment that's coming one day. And the psalmist tells us the wicked will not stand in the judgment. He does not mean that the wicked will somehow avoid judgment. He means that their case will not stand up in court. The wicked will not stand with the righteous. There will be a separation between the righteous and the wicked. I've heard people say on a number of occasions, I don't want to go with heaven. I don't want to go to heaven. I don't want to be with all the hypocrites. Well, my friend, if you don't go to heaven, you will be with all the hypocrites. The hypocrites may think themselves doing rather well now in various churches and such, but God knows who are the real people and who are the hypocrites, and he will make that separation. The righteous will stand in the judgment, not because we're in a great deal, but because we're depending upon the righteousness of Jesus, the only being in the universe who is both created and uncreated, who chose to become a created being, who can give away his righteousness then because he doesn't owe it to God, and who lived a perfect life. And if we trust in him, his righteousness counts as ours, and we will stand in the judgment because of his righteousness, not because of ours. What difference does it make when we die? Verse 6 pictures the eternal state of that period which we will experience after the last judgment. And the psalmist tells us that God knows the way of the righteous. I suggest God knows the lifestyle of the righteous. And knows here is probably stronger than just intellectually aware of it, but loves or approves the lifestyle of the righteous, as we see by the contrast of the other half of the verse, that the way of the wicked will perish, the lifestyle of the wicked will perish. The Bible doesn't tell us that the wicked will cease to exist. We look through the biblical material, although many of us perhaps would wish that that's what it taught. That is not what it teaches. And the Bible teaches that the wicked will personally continue to exist, and yet it calls their existence the second death. But their lifestyle will cease to exist. The lifestyle of the wicked in this life is doing what they want without reaping all the consequences of it. But the lifestyle of the wicked in the age to come, they may still do a good deal of what they want, though, of course, no one ever does everything they want, but they will now reap the consequences continually. This may even be an explanation for the eternality of hell. I don't know. I know what the Bible teaches, but I don't know how to harmonize all of it and how to justify all of it. But a suggestion that was made to me by a friend years ago was the picture of Lazarus and the rich man in that parable by Jesus in Luke chapter 16. And he pointed out that in the state there, it's not the final hell, but it's the intermediate state, kind of the intermediate hell between death and the resurrection, that the rich man is still sinning, he's still complaining, etc. And he suggested that those who are in hell will continue to sin, and they'll be punished for each of those new sins. They've turned down the only way to escape from their sinfulness, and so God has left them in their sinfulness. Their lifestyle of being able to sin and not reap all the consequences is gone. They now sin and reap all the consequences. And so it might be that after you've been in hell 10 or 20 or 30 years, that you have been punished for all the things you committed in this life, but look at all the things you will have committed in the 10 or 20 or 30 years that you've now been in hell and will continue to do and continue to be punished for. A scary picture. The lifestyle of the wicked will perish. They'll personally continue to exist. Their lifestyle will cease to exist. They will still continue to sin, but now will be punished immediately. Conclusion. What is life all about? Where do we find out? From God. Where else? What difference does it make here and now? It makes a difference of whether our life is useful or wasted. What difference will it make when we die? All the difference in the world.